You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēs te tōku ingoa, no mahaere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rātū Tuesday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Faith. If I can, coming up on the show for Dear Science this week, our expert Daniel Thomas chats with us about rice arriving in the Pacific, native forests sinking carbon, and seaweed used for grooming orchids. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, I ask about the Regulatory Standards Bill in light of it going to Select Committee. Faith, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Larissa Hockey from the Long COVID Kids organisation about the effects of long COVID on children and how the issue should be addressed. I also spoke to the CEO of Cannabis Clinic NZ, Dr. Wasim Alzar, about the stigma around medical cannabis.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e warawara e aha ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te paitukutuku o Erirangi Poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science this week, we are joined by a new guest, our expert, Daniel. And you've got lots of science for us today, right?
Yeah, I do. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Hang on, I'll just move the mic a little closer. Yeah, so we've got lots of stories here, and in celebration of Kiribati Language Week, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's Kiribati Language Week here in Aotearoa, so Wikin te Taitai ne Kiribati. And so I thought I'd choose some science stories that might, where I might be able to find a connection to Kiribati, even if the stories aren't about Kiribati directly. Sound okay?
Yeah.
So I'll jump into it.
Yeah, the first one about rice in the Pacific. What's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit of background. So the most widely accepted theory for the origins of Austronesian people, so this includes modern Pacific peoples and hence the people of Kiribati, are migrations from Taiwan through the Philippines and then into the wider Pacific region starting at around 5,000 years ago. And so the last major land mass, of course, in these migrations to be settled is us here in Aotearoa. And in Aotearoa, where, you know, we know that these migration events involved incredible planning because of the taonga species that were brought along, things like kumara for establishing colonies. Well, this new study has found the same type of planning in the earliest of these migration studies as well. And so the first evidence of rice entering the Pacific has been discovered in an ancient cave site in Guam, which is in the Mariana Islands in western Micronesia. So rice was originally domesticated in central China around 9,000 years ago and was brought into Taiwan and into the Philippines, where it was a staple food.
Yeah, big. I mean, lots of different cultures have their, you know, staple foods. We see potatoes in the Americas, right? Rice there, grains like corn and wheat in Europe mostly, I'd imagine.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So rice, I mean, important to these people as food, but also culturally, I'd imagine, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so here is this staple food for this group of explorers that are about to head off on what would become a 2,300-kilometer journey from the Philippines out eventually into the Mariana Islands. And so it was these explorers that actually packed up staple foods that they'd use to establish their colony once they arrived, and that would include, of course, rice. Mm. And so that was the idea for the longest time, and it's only just now that the first evidence for this has actually been found. Mm. And so the presence of abundant rice husk and leaf phytoliths have been found. And so phytoliths are these glass-like structures that are found inside of rice plants. And so these phytoliths stay around long after the rice has gone. And so these things, these rice husks and these phytoliths were found in the Ratidian site complex in Guam, and the pottery has been, or the sediments and all of this structure has been dated to around 3,500 years
ago. Wow, so quite old. How well was it preserved, I guess?
Yeah, so preserved, these glass phytoliths are well preserved. They will preserve for a very long time. The evidence of the husks, these are actually just impressions pressed in against the pottery itself.
But still strong evidence that it was there. Yeah.
Well, the one thing they needed to check was actually, were these phytoliths or husks, were they actually in the pottery or were they on the pottery?
And right.
It makes a difference because perhaps they were part of the pottery and made elsewhere, or maybe they were put into the pottery on site and used for storage. And it's the latter. They were actually, this pottery was used to store this rice.
Yeah. And so, and then, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, but why are we not seeing, I guess, evidence of rice further or more recently than this in these places?
Yeah, so it turns out that once you arrive in Guam, there's not a huge amount of place to grow large fields of rice.
Yeah.
And so it is grown, or certainly was, in small scale. And so rice is used as ceremonial purposes, as you mentioned, and hasn't become a staple food. Instead, what we've seen is this shift towards the Oceania style of diet.
Yeah.
So seafood, coconuts, the traditional foods of what you'd find in Kiribati.
Very interesting. And then this next story about native forests sinking carbon. This is always nice, the fact that we have a little bit to offset the atrocious things we're doing to our atmosphere.
Yeah, and that's exactly what this story is. So I'm going to actually lead here with my Kiribati connection. And so that's because Kiribati has this unfortunate status of being the first country expected to disappear due to climate change. And that is because the area of Kiribati is so low-lying that rising sea level is an existential threat. And so understanding climate change, having a good sense of it, is obviously very important to all of us, but it's really close to home for people in Kiribati. And so this new climate change research actually is about Aotearoa forests. And it turns out that New Zealand's native forests are actually absorbing more carbon dioxide than previously thought.
Yeah, that's big, right? It's got to be good news.
Yeah, absolutely. And so a team led by staff at NIWA, so National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, have used an inverse modelling approach to figure this out. And so this inverse modelling is where you kind of know the answer, so you figure out the rest of the equation, what must be going on in order to arrive at the answer.
So we know, I'm guessing the answer is how much carbon is going away?
Yeah, is in the air around us.
Yeah.
And we know some parts of the other parts of that answer are how much we're sort of generating locally. So the missing piece there is how much is being absorbed to make all sense of this. And to put this into context, so we are actually producing around 78.8 million tons of carbon annually. And so that's a 2020 number. That's the closest that I could find. Earlier work had found that maybe New Zealand was absorbing 24 to 118 million. So
that's a big range.
It's a huge range. Yeah. And so maybe we were absorbing all of that we were producing, but maybe not.
We were producing one third. Yeah, that range seems a bit unuseful.
Yeah, and so this group have come along with these more sophisticated methods using a longer series of data and really taken a good stab at it. And what they've found is that actually New Zealand's land ecosystems are absorbing 171 million tons.
That's got to be good.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a lot more than the 80-ish million that we're producing locally. So that kind of means that New Zealand is a net sink for carbon dioxide.
Well, that's great news.
Well, it is. And so the great thing about this is in looking here, they found that it's healthy, mature forests that are doing most of the work. And their big takeaway from this is anything that we do to make our forests healthier actually has this flow-on effect to making our atmosphere healthier. So healthy forests, good for climate change.
Yeah, and that's sort of intuitive, right? You'd imagine, you know, when the trees are doing well, they can do their job a bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. And so bringing this back to Kiribati, any efforts that we can do here in Aotearoa with our forests, make them healthier, makes the atmosphere healthier, slows down the rate that kiribati might disappear under the ocean.
Yeah, and then this last story, seaweed used for grooming orcas. Seaweed, I mean, and grooming themselves. I mean, orcas, we know are smart animals, but I mean, grooming? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. So this one, I couldn't actually find a connection to kiribati, right. But I saw this and I couldn't help myself.
That's good. I like that.
So tools are used by an increasing number of animals, but most of the animals that we see using tools, things like clever New Caledonian crows using sticks to solve puzzles, most of those animals live on land. We actually have relatively little evidence of animals using tools if they live in the ocean. And part of that's a bias. Hmm. We live on land. That's where we're looking. But it turns out that orca have now been added to this list of tool users. There have been earlier observations of cetaceans. So cetaceans are whales, dolphins, porpoises of using tools, specifically kelp.
Hmm.
So these animals having kelp draped over their bodies, a behavior called kelping.
Uh-huh.
What is the porpoise of this? So possibly they're playing. Possibly it's skin care. A little unclear, but there are great images of things like grey whales wearing kelp hats that I highly encourage everyone to look up. But this is different. So in July last year, a group of researchers recorded orca in the Salish Sea, which is between Canada and the United States on the Pacific side. And what they were doing is they were swimming up past a piece of bull kelp, so a large floating raft of kelp, and they would bite off a stem of it, and they would grab a piece of that kelp and swim up to another orca and put that piece of kelp between the two orca, and then the two would swim along and roll against one another with that piece of kelp.
It sounds like quite an advanced process.
Exactly. Yeah. The planning that's involved, the choosing of the piece of kelp, the identifying the individual, having to swim to keep these pieces of kelp between them. Absolutely. So there's drone footage of this behavior happening between grandparent and a grandson, parent and daughter, sibling and brother. And so it was observed quite a few times, and what's been found is that mostly the orca that are doing this are doing this with close relatives or those of similar age.
Mm.
And so you asked, what's it for? What's going on? The best idea is that it's some kind of social skin maintenance.
Mm.
So these are animals that don't have hands. So anything that's affecting
their skin. Yeah, just sort of rub up against each other.
Exactly. So it's a way of keeping the skin nice and clean, and it also helps reinforce social bonds.
Yeah.
So it's not referred to as kelping in this case. It's got a new term. It's allo-kelping.
Allo-kelping.
Exactly.
Mm, interesting.
So kelping others. And so this is where I do have a small kiribati connection. Mm. So, and that is, I learned that helping one another in the kiribati language is te ubopoki e maranana.
Hmm, that's nice. Yeah, so if we're thinking about kelping or allo-kelping, right? I mean, obviously a skincare routine used by orcas, maybe now also used by humans. We can get together and rub a bit of kelp between us.
you can try it if you like.
Or take all the learnings of Dear Science with you, I suppose. Don't integrate all of them in your personal lives, but maybe this one, just for fun, inspire some thought in yourself, inspire some fun. That's nice to hear. All right, well, thank you for sharing these science stories with us, Daniel, this week. Very interesting stuff. Thank you, as always, to Motet, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
I just want to say how proud we are. I remember when you were just water, malt, hops, and yeast. They just brew up so fast.
Holy heck! Hallertau's turning 20! To celebrate, the Barons of Beer are throwing a huge family-friendly party on Sunday, July 20th, and a barnstorming adults-only shindig on Saturday, July 26th.
Plus, from July 1st, Hallertau will be announcing a new giveaway every day for 20 days.
Head to hallertau.co.nz or follow Hallertau's socials for details.
Dive into pools of textual colour at a Century of Modern Art exhibition at Auckland Art Gallery, Toi o Tamaki, on now until September 28th.
Witness Van Gogh's emotive brushstrokes, Monet's evocative landscapes, Rauschenberg's bold abstractions, and many more works that revolutionized Western art history and continue to inspire new generations.
Become a member and get free, unlimited entry to this dazzling exhibition, as well as members' lounge access, invitations to exclusive events, discounts, and more. Find out more at AucklandArtGallery.com.
Future sounds from the underground. The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world.
Totally Wired.
Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future. Next month, even.
Some of these tracks are like 2026 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95 BFM. Thanks to Flying Out. flyingout.co.nz.
Hello, Ms. Toucan. Morning, Mr. Sloth, Mrs. Sloth. And how are you, Mr. Big, Scary, Ferocious Lion?
You never know what you'll find on the BFM Kids Show, bringing stories, songs, games, and all kinds of fun to your Sunday morning since forever ago. The 95 BFM Kids Show with Finn, 7 to 9 every Sunday morning on BFM.
I'm not gonna die on this hill, or maybe I will. Summer's over, it's sad, but I'm still burning bad. Can't keep calling it grief, or hoping it's brief. When you live in the world, but I live underneath. Who will water the plants? Are they just gonna be another thing that dies from spending time around me? I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag, and you got free. I got heartbreak for jet lag. Said as you lay on my bed, and I haven't been back, cause I'm scared I might crack. I'm a million girls and a few want to kill, but the others are sweet, so I'll probably be still. You said you're not feeling me. Who gave you the nerve? Said you're not feeling free, like I'm caging a bird. I got heartbreak for jet lag.
Climbing, having some solar time, if that's what you need, and staying sober, or at least
Please take care of yourself. I love you. I'll see you soon.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Tom Rutherford.
Welcome back to The Wire. Hearings on the Regulatory Standards Bill are currently underway, with around 23,000 total submissions, both written and oral. Early analysis of the submissions estimated 88% are in opposition, while only 0.3% are in support. The bill has been pushed by Minister for Regulation and ACT Party leader David Seymour, who says it should support the government to reduce regulation and ensure the protection of individual rights and private property. The bill has been criticised for not including clauses around te tiriti o Waitangi or environmental protections. It has also been criticised for potentially undemocratic elements, placing large amounts of control in the hands of the unelected Ministry for Regulation. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I asked Tom Rutherford about the new Regulatory Standards Bill in light of the Select Committee hearings and new criticisms. Submissions on the Regulatory Standards Bill are currently being heard in Select Committee. Before we get into the submissions and perspectives on the bill, what is the bill and why is the government looking at implementing it?
Yeah, so the purpose of the Regulatory Standards Bill is to improve the quality of New Zealand's regulations by allowing ineffective or inconsistent rules to be reviewed transparently. The bill is about lifting the standard of regulatory decision-making, ensuring rules do what they're intended to do and are based on clear principles and deliver results for New Zealanders. It's before the Select Committee at the moment, the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee, which is an appropriate forum for people to for the committee to hear from expert and public submissions and ensuring all potential impacts are properly considered. I think it's really important, and I hope we'll talk about it through this interview, that we talk about what's included in the bill and what's not included in the bill, because there's been a lot of information out in the public around what people are concerned about, and it'd be great to clarify that as well.
Just before we get into that, we've seen similar bills to this one rejected under previous governments. What's different this time?
Yeah, I obviously this is my first term, so wasn't part of those considerations when they were previous legislations were considered in previous governments, but this bill is about lifting the standard of regulatory decision making. It's vital that we get the bill right, and the government is really open to receiving feedback from academics, legal experts, industry and the public, as we're seeing at the moment with public submissions to the Select Committee.
We've seen a lot of criticism of the bill around its lack of consideration towards things like our nation's founding document, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and other factors important to our national identity, such as protections for our environment and native species, which are absent in the new Regulatory Standards Bill, which is looking at things like protecting private property rights or protecting individual freedoms. Why is this?
Yeah, so some people have raised concerns that the treaty isn't explicitly referenced in the Regulatory Standards Bill, but it's important to be clear that the bill does not override or weaken treaty obligations, and any recommendations made under it are non-binding. The intent is to improve how regulations are assessed, not to interfere with the Crown's ability to meet any commitments. It only creates a non-binding accountability and review process. It includes no mechanism for invalidating or overruling legislation, even if it concerns treaty-based rights, and it does not prevent the Crown or Parliament from continuing to give effect to treaty obligations in future legislation.
ACT Party leader David Seymour has spoken out about the exclusion of te tiriti from this bill, similar to how you mentioned earlier, saying the inclusion of te tiriti wouldn't help reduce red tape, and mentioned, as you did earlier, that it wouldn't overrule existing legislation, it would merely provide guidance. While this is true, should we really be prioritising the removal of regulation and advice about the removal of regulation over existing factors, such as our nation's founding document?
Yeah, so as I said before, some have raised concerns that the treaty isn't explicitly referenced in the bill, but it's important to be clear that the bill does not override or weaken treaty obligations, and any recommendations that are made are non-binding. The intent is to improve how regulations are assessed, not to interfere with the Crown's ability to meet any commitments.
The bill is set to be implemented by the Ministry of Regulation, and this government has talked at length, both in its creation of the Ministry of Regulation and in other areas, about cutting red tape. As you've mentioned, the bill would allow this committee to establish recommendations on existing legislation or on future legislation. Is this just introducing, you know, new red tape moving forward for other governments to consider?
No, this is about making sure that the quality of legislation that future parliaments are bringing in are in line with what we want to be doing as a country. So, you know, as I said earlier, it's about lifting the standard of regulatory decision making. And it's really important to clarify what the bill does versus what it doesn't do. So what it does is it sets out the principles of sound regulatory practice and gives a mechanism to test whether existing or proposed regulations meet those principles. It allows for independent reviews of regulations and regulatory decision-making and aims to improve the transparency of quality regulatory frameworks across government. It does not give courts or reviewers the power to strike down laws or regulations. It does not override Parliament. Recommendations made through the reviews are not binding. And it does not restrict academic freedom or public debate.
If we're looking at analysis of the submissions now, some 23,000, with around 88% looking in opposition and less than a percent of submissions in clear support of the bill. This seems like a pretty blatant show of opposition. How do you expect this will factor into the government's decisions on the bill moving forward?
Yeah, so the bill's currently before the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee. They just started their first day of hearings yesterday on the legislation and are carrying on throughout this week and moving forward. That is the appropriate forum for hearing expert and public submissions. It's vital we get the legislation right, and we would welcome feedback from academics, legal experts, industry and the general public on the bill. As I'm personally following the process closely and am committed to considering the evidence and concerns raised through the submissions, as are my colleagues who sit on the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee as well. And it's undergoing the scrutiny, and that's a good part of our parliamentary process, about having legislation going to select committees and for the general public to submit on legislation, whether it's in favour or opposed, to improve the legislation wherever possible.
Just more on that a little bit. We've seen, as I mentioned, this large degree of opposition. How will that sort of turnout factor into the government's consideration of whether to pass the bill or not moving forward?
Yeah, well, that'll be a consideration that the select committee members themselves will have to consider as they go through their process of listening and hearing the submissions and then their work beyond that. I'm not a member of that committee, so I can't speak specifically to the discussions they may or may not be having, but that is a democratic part of being on a select committee and inviting the public to make their submissions on legislation.
Yeah, and on that democratic element, it's been a topic of discussion, the democratic elements of this bill and the ideas around it. Obviously, 23,000 submissions, a difficult number for any group to assess fully and properly. And there's been some concerns about those submissions not being treated with the full respect or not being fully covered each. However, if we're thinking about this bill moving forward, you know, is taking this bill to a referendum something that the government would be considering, you know, to ensure that it is a bill that all of the country is on board with?
I don't want to speak out of turn, but I haven't been made aware of any consideration around whether this legislation would be taken to referendum. That's not something I'm aware of at this time. But as I said, I'm not a member of the select committee that's currently considering the bill. And so that's the extent of my knowledge around that particular aspect.
Lastly here, I just wanted to talk about the National Party and the media response to the bill. We've seen from the government that a lot of the commentary on the bill and a lot of the discussion around the bill has been led by ACT's leader David Seymour, with the National Party and Prime Minister Christopher Luxon taking a backseat there. Why has the National Party been, you know, relatively silent on this bill compared to others put out under this government?
Yeah, well, this is a bill that is being led by David Seymour as the Minister for Regulation. So he is the minister in charge. So he is doing his due diligence and duty as the minister leading this legislation. Just would be the case if we were talking about legislation, say, for example, about justice, with Paul Goldsmith leading that, say, some of the announcements we had last week. He's the Minister for Justice. And in this case, David Seymour's the Minister for Regulation, and rightly so, he's been leading the charge on this legislation.
That was the National Party's Tom Rutherford speaking to me about the Regulatory Standards Bill.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Tom Rutherford.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95 BFM.
sleep. I've been running wild for you anyway. 'Cause there's something I gotta say.
Earnestly. There are times when I'm lost and lonely, yeah, anyway. 'Cause there's something
on you pavement, and you don't even feel it. It's a crime. For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. A recent study from the University of Otago shows that more than 20% of children in Aotearoa who have been infected by COVID-19 still suffer persistent ongoing symptoms. I spoke to Larissa Hockey from the Long COVID Kids organisation about long COVID effects and how it affects children and how they are specifically at risk. What are the effects of long COVID and how do they affect children specifically?
Right, so long COVID has around 200 different symptoms, and particularly in children that will look like sore stomachs, fatigue, just lack of energy. Those are the most prominent things, aches and pains, headaches. And one of the key symptoms of long COVID is what we call post-exertional malaise, so that after doing some kind of activity, exercise, or it may even be emotional or social, people will feel worse. So a child might feel okay, they go out and play, and then they come back and they're feeling worse. And that's a key symptom for long COVID in adults and children.
And what has this recent study shown that previous studies haven't picked up on?
Well, this is the first time that the long-term impacts of COVID have been studied in children in New Zealand, and that's why it's really important. It shows that there are long-term effects in approximately 20% of children, and what we really need to do is continue to monitor this. We need to keep researching it to see if there's any change. Are the children who have shown that they are continuing to be unwell, are they improving or are they still unwell? Are there more children? So we do need to continue with the research.
Are there any particular demographics of children that are more at risk of long COVID's health effects, whether it's ones with underlying conditions or, let's say, children from lower socioeconomic backgrounds?
Right, so it does show that children who have got pre-existing conditions are more likely to have long-term effects from COVID, but that it's still a lot of children that have had no previous conditions are still showing that these effects can happen.
What do you think our public health sector should do to address these issues?
Oh, we definitely need to look at clean air for starters. Children are in classrooms where they've got, you know, 20 to 30 kids in there. Someone comes into school with COVID and it very easily spreads in that situation. So we need to be improving the air quality in our classrooms and our daycares. You know, little children, they're constantly picking up viruses and passing them on. So if we can try and reduce that, then that's really going to be very beneficial, because obviously you're not going to get long COVID if you don't get COVID in the first place.
And before we wrap up the interview, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Just that long COVID is making a huge impact in children's lives. You know, children are unable to play, socialise, go to school. You know, we've got children in our support group who haven't been to school for 2 or 3 years, and it's having a huge toll on them and their families who are supporting them. And so we need to avoid this growing. We need to reduce infections so that we don't have so many children continuing to get sick. And we need to invest in research, because at the moment there are no treatments.
That was Larissa Hockey on long COVID in children. We will be right back after a short break, so keep it on the B.
don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. A new research study shows that two-thirds of Kiwis believe that there is still a stigma around medicinal cannabis usage, and that users are still subject to negative stereotypes. I spoke to Dr. Wasim Al-Zar from Cannabis Clinic NZ about the stigma and what steps need to be taken to normalise its usage.
Why would some medicinal cannabis users feel ashamed about their usage?
People feel ashamed about their usage. It's a good question. The reality is cannabis has been criminalised for such a long time. And people and us have held on to those beliefs over that period of time, and it's been ingrained in us that cannabis is a drug, therefore it's bad, ignoring the fact that us doctors are prescribing drugs all day, every day, and that somehow this is different or worse. So it comes down to that, and also that belief exists within like the medical community itself, within our doctors, our clinicians, which is really unfortunate, but it's a real area and opportunity for education. So when we did our research, we found that 66% of people who responded felt that there was still stigma around medicinal cannabis.
Do you think that there are any particular groups or demographics that get negatively stereotyped?
People imagine, like, you know, dreadlocks and Bob Marley and somebody, you know, just, you know, having a joint in the corner, that type of thing. Look, I think anybody who uses cannabis is up for potential judgment and discrimination. Probably less so the people who use it, who are like high performing, you know, professionals that just do it really, really secretly. Whereas others who maybe do it more, you know, share it with others or maybe more publicly get judged or stereotyped. I think the other part is people going to their doctor to try and talk about it, fear being judged by their doctor. Like their doctor, you know, will my doctor think that I am a drug seeker, in quotation marks. This is a big term that's used in medicine, right? Drug seeker. You know, does my doctor think that I'm just there wanting to get cannabis off them or something along those lines? So, yeah, I think anybody in general who uses cannabis and tries to, you know, goes publicly about it will face judgment, whether it's positive or negative, because there's also positive judgment. But the stigma definitely still exists. And same thing for us. Like, I'm a clinician, I'm a doctor, heavily believe in what we're doing. And we see the stigma in our own community from other clinicians, the medical council, and, you know, people around us. And so it's everywhere. It's across the board.
And what do you think can be done to normalise the usage of medicinal cannabis?
It comes down to education. Like, education and us putting ourselves out there and actually having more and more people use it and openly use it. Like, we try and encourage, you know, people, if they've had success with using medicinal cannabis, we encourage people to talk to their friends and share that story with other people around them in their community, because that gets people understanding. But it also comes down to education. And education means that we can talk freely about it. And the reality is there's so many restrictions around medicinal cannabis or cannabis in general, which limits our ability to educate, talk about it, talk about the product, talk about how much it costs, talk about the potential benefits, talk about the potential, you know, side effects. And if we can't have like a conversation without fearing like, oh, is this advertising of products? Is this like illegal? Are the regulators going to be upset by this? Then how can we progress as a society? That's like almost keeping the taboo and the stigma in place. And I think there's so many people that would otherwise benefit from it. Like, there's so many people that have sleeping problems, and that's me, that have you know, problems with pain, or they have anxiety or mental health issues that are just dealing with it by themselves, and they're just so scared to come up and talk about it. And I was one of them, because it took me a long time to get my head around like being prescribed cannabis. So I get it. But then it's all those people that then end up missing out on their quality of life and miss out on such a valuable and special plant that has been given to us, and then the quality of life suffers at the end. And it's, yeah, so I think it comes down to like education. Let's talk about it. Let's just be adults and grown-ups about it. We don't have to hide away from stuff and pretend it doesn't exist.
And what steps should be taken in order for medicinal cannabis to get taken seriously by GPs on the same level as, let's say, more conventional medicines?
It starts off from the top. Like, for like, you've got to lead by example. And when I say that, I mean the medical council, the College of General Practitioners, which represents most GPs in the country. They do the training, right? They need to be proactive about it and come up and actually lead that forward. So basically what the government has said, the government in 2021 has said, having medicinal cannabis is better for the country, so we're going to make a prescription for any doctor. So the government's recognized the benefit. So then it needs to be passed on to the regulators within the medical industry who say, right, government has said this, there's value, let's make sure we provide guidelines that help doctors and guide them in this process. Instead, what they've done is they've put guidelines and policies in place which actually prevent doctors from doing it and saying, you're better off not to prescribe it, make sure you've tried all the first-line treatments first, and even if you do, prescribe it with caution. And if you screw it up, we're going to come after you. From a medical legal point of view, right? And that last part hasn't been said, but it's effectively what has been happening in practical, you know, everyday experience. And that doesn't help anyone. Like, how can doctors? How do we address the stigma? And how do we educate the community when we're approaching it like this? And so it starts from the top. You've got to be proactive, open-minded, embrace change. And then lead it and say, guys, this is the direction that the government is going in. Let's embrace it. Let's all move forward as a progressive country. And let's bring everybody, you know, all the doctors along for that journey. But while that gets figured out and that gets sorted out, we're here doing what we're doing, which is just pushing cannabis forward because we really, really believe in it. We don't think that the stigma is false, shouldn't be there. And we're just out there promoting it. Promoting our service to people and saying, this is what we do, this is what we specialize in, and we're a safe place for people to come and talk about it. There's no judgment. We believe in it, you know, and we're forward-thinking, and we're going to deliver healthcare to a really, really high standard. So come talk to us about it. And that's the approach that we've taken to help do our part.
That was Cannabis Clinic's Dr. Waseem Alzar on the stigma around medicinal cannabis.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Daniel Thomas, National's Tom Rutherford, Larissa Hockey from the Long COVID Kids Association, and Cannabis Clinic's Dr. Waseem Alzar. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Jen.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.